Good afternoon. I'm Robert Kippers, the President of the Securities and Exchange Commission Historical Society. It's my pleasure to welcome all of you present here today in New York City and all of you listening at www.sechistorical.org to the Society's sixth annual meeting. The SEC Historical Society is a nonprofit organization founded in 1999 to preserve and share the history of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission and of the securities industry through our virtual museum and archive at www.sechistorical.org. Today's annual meeting will be preserved in the virtual museum and archived after the broadcast. I'd also like to thank the more than 2,800 visitors who come to the museum each month and the many persons who have contributed to the growth of our collections. My fellow trustees join me in expressing our gratitude to the more than 500 donors, both individuals and institutions, who generously give to support our work. Today's annual meeting is the first to be held outside of Washington, D.C., and it's also the first to receive some sponsorships. I'd like to thank the generous support of Calorama Partners, LLC, our principal sponsor, and of Pfizer, Inc. I would also like to thank the in-kind support of Bear Stearns & Company and of Deloitte & Touche, LLP. Finally, and importantly, I'd like to express the Society's appreciation to the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission for their continuing friendship and support for our work. While the Society is independent of and separate from the SEC and receives no funding from it, we are grateful for the SEC's ongoing partnership with us. I'd also like to acknowledge the presence of Mark Schoenfeld and his colleagues from the SEC's Northeast Regional Office. The SEC's Northeast Region lost its office at 7 World Trade Center on September 11, 2001. After a few years in the Woolworth Building, they have just relocated to the World Financial Center. We have with us today SEC Commissioner Cynthia A. Glassman. Commissioner Glassman has been very generous with her time and with her support of the Society. Please welcome her to share remarks on behalf of the SEC.
Thank you, Bob. It's an honor to be here today at the SEC Historical Society's sixth annual meeting. As you know, I must give our standard disclaimer that the views I express are my own and don't necessarily represent the views of the commission or the staff. As the longest-serving current commissioner, I personally think that I've been part of a very historical time. I'm now about to be on my third chairman in as many years. Perhaps the folks at the Society who keep track of these things can let me know when I hit the record for most turnover during one appointment. Seriously, this year's theme, Crisis and Resolve, Remembrance of September 11th, 2001, provides us all with an opportunity to reflect on the great strength of our nation, its people, its institutions, and its financial markets. And while it's true that Washington, D.C. was also targeted on September 11th, I believe it's appropriate that this meeting is being held in New York, which is the center of our nation's financial markets. September 11th had the potential to wreak havoc in our financial markets. Indeed, immediately in the aftermath, the trading markets closed. Nonetheless, within days, the markets were reopened and functioning smoothly. The Securities and Exchange Commission, under the chairmanship of Harvey Pitt, was integral in the process to reopen our financial markets and ensure their orderly operations. The incredible determination evidenced by all in the securities industry stands as a testament to our resolve to overcome adversity. Although I was not a commissioner during the September 11th crisis, I was at the commission when scandals erupted at well-known corporations and in the mutual fund industry. The corporate scandals ultimately led to passage of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, the most sweeping securities legislation of our generation. Similarly, the late trading and market timing fiasco at various mutual fund complexes resulted in commission enactment of numerous rules requiring not only greater disclosures and stronger compliance, but also restructured governance. From a historical standpoint, other than right after the creation of the SEC itself, it's difficult to conceive of a period of greater activity at the Commission than has been experienced in the past few years. Frankly, I feel I've had a sufficient number of historical moments to last a lifetime. And I hope that the remainder of my time at the Commission is served during what historians will refer to as the mundane years. In closing, I'd like to note that the Historical Society serves as a wonderful complement to the Commission and to our financial markets. By providing the context for the activities, both past and present, undertaken by the SEC in furtherance of our mission to protect investors and maintain the integrity of the securities markets. As a non-SEC alumni, when I was appointed, I found this context to be a great resource for me. I'm thankful to the Society for its existence and for its passion to preserve the important history of the SEC. Thank you for providing me with an opportunity to address you today. You have an interesting program that's planned, which because of a prior commitment, I'm going to have to watch on the replay. But I do wish the Society much continued success with its very important mission. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Glassman. The theme of our annual meeting is Crisis and Resolve. The SEC and the securities industry remember September 11th, 2001. 80 years ago, in 1925, Colonel William Mitchell of the then Army Air Corps wrote of the possibility of a single explosion well placed by aircraft in the heart of New York City, which could wreck tall buildings, close the New York Stock Exchange, put communication and transportation systems out of order, and paralyze the financial center of the Western Hemisphere. As far-fetched as Colonel Mitchell's prediction seemed when it was made 80 years ago, this possibility became a reality, a terrible one, on September 11th, 2001. Before looking at the impact of the events of that day on the capital market system, I ask that you join in a moment of silence to remember all those who lost their lives and all those whose lives were forever altered by the events of that day. Thank you. The human toll of the events of September 11, 2001 will always be front and center whenever that date is spoken or read. The heroism of those that rushed into harm's way both on that day and in the days following is legend. Today we examine a different facet of the tragedy, the threat it imposed to our capital markets. The story of the challenges faced by the securities industry and those in government responsible for the orderly operation of our markets has never been fully told. We are fortunate to have with us those that lived through the aftermath and, like so many others, showed leadership in doing what had to be done. We'll begin with our panel, moderated by Wayne Carlin. On September 11, 2001, Wayne was the SEC's Northeast Regional Administrator. Today he's in private practice with Wachtell Lipton. And I'll let Wayne introduce the rest of his panel. Wayne?
Thank you, Bob. To my left is Annette Nazareth, who is Director of the Division of Market Regulation at the SEC, and also held that position on September 11th, 2001. Prior to being the Division Director, Annette held other significant positions on the staff, and before joining the Commission, among other things, she held important legal positions in firms including Solomon Smith Barney and Lehman Brothers. To Annette's left is Ed Qualwasser, Ed is now senior counsel at the law firm of Proskauer Rose here in New York. Before joining Proskauer, Ed had a long career in a senior role at the New York Stock Exchange, and on September 11th, he was executive vice president in charge of regulation at the exchange. And before the exchange, Ed also had a distinguished career on the staff of the SEC. To Ed's left is Tom Russo, who's chief legal officer of Lehman Brothers Holdings and vice chairman of Lehman Brothers, Inc. Before joining Lehman Brothers, he was a partner in the law firm of Cadwallader, Wickersham & Taft. Earlier in his career, Tom worked in the Division of Market Regulation at the SEC and was a pioneer in the field of commodities regulation, including serving as the first director of the CFTC's Division of Trading and Markets. There's one person who's not here today who sends his regrets. That's David Becker, who was general counsel at the SEC on September 11th. David received an invitation to attend a meeting at a federal agency in Washington, and it was not the kind of invitation that he could decline, but he sends his regrets. What we're going to do on this panel is really in three stages. First, each of us, from our varying perspectives, is going to tell you how we first learned what was happening on September 11th and the early reactions and early issues that we dealt with. Then we're going to turn to discussing what was involved in getting things up and running again, what was involved in protecting investors and restoring confidence in the marketplace, again, each from our different perspectives. And then finally, we will talk about lessons learned from the experience. As you've heard, I was on September 11th the regional director in charge of the Northeast Regional Office. The office was in 7 World Trade Center, which was across the plaza from the Twin Towers, and that was the third building that was destroyed on September 11th. I wasn't there that day. I was in San Francisco at a NASA conference, the Organization of the State Securities Regulators. I was there along with my counterparts, the other regional directors of the other 4 regional offices, as well as Jim Clarkson from the Washington staff. And on the morning of September 11th, the NASA conference was over, and I was supposed to fly home from San Francisco on a flight that was supposed to take off at about 6:30 in the morning, San Francisco time. So shortly after 6 a.m. San Francisco time, I boarded the plane, and within minutes of sitting down, my beeper went off, and it was Chairman Pitt's office paging me, not knowing that I was sitting on a runway in San Francisco. I pulled out a cell phone and called and got a member of Chairman Pitt's staff who explained that she was calling to find out if everything was okay or what was happening at the office in New York. When I expressed puzzlement, she told me that there were reports that an airplane had hit one of the towers, and that was the first that I heard of it. Within a couple of minutes after that, they told us to get off the plane and go back into the departure lounge, where, of course, the TV monitors had CNN with the early coverage. This was still shortly after 9 in the morning, New York time. I tried to make a few phone calls completely unsuccessfully from a payphone, and it quickly became clear that my flight wasn't going to leave, and there were no flights that were going to leave. So I got in a cab and went back to my hotel and checked back in, went back to the room that I had vacated about an hour earlier, which is where I ended up spending most of that week. So although I wasn't at the Northeast Regional Office that day, of course, I quickly heard plenty about what had happened. Some of the staff were already there when the first plane hit. A lot of other people were in the vicinity on their way into the office, and frankly, the people who were in the vicinity on the plaza or coming out of the subway were the people who tended to have the most harrowing experiences that day. The first thing that leaped to everyone's mind was the need to track down the 320 or so members of the Northeast Regional Office staff to make sure that everyone had had gotten out and had gotten away safely, and so the initial focus was entirely on dealing with the human aspect of the crisis. And when Chairman Pitt reached me by phone later that day, the one thing that he told me was to be focused on tracking down the people and attending to the people, and to not worry about anything else that day. Everyone on the staff did get out and did get away safely. The closest call was a young woman named Lourdes Vega, who was an examiner on the broker-dealer exam staff, who was on the 80-something floor of one of the towers conducting a broker-dealer exam, just a few floors below where the plane hit. I heard about her that day, and I reached her by phone that evening, and I know Chairman Pitt did also. Her reaction when I spoke to her was really emblematic of a lot of what I saw in the staff in the days and weeks after after these events, because the main thing that Lourdes was concerned about, having been a few floors below where the plane hit, was she was kicking herself that she hadn't thought to grab her SEC laptop before walking down 80 flights of stairs to save her life. Late that day, I spent most of that day on the telephone, although not a lot of calls went through, but late that day with the TV in the background in my hotel room, I watched as 7 World Trade Center collapsed. It was not really until that moment that that the scope of what we were going to have to deal with in the office hit me, I'll address that phase of things when I get the microphone back. The last thing to just finish up the immediate aftermath for me is I stayed in San Francisco through that week, each day with a plane reservation for the next day, thinking I was going to fly back, and then the next day the flights were canceled. So finally, on Friday of the week, I decided the only way I was sure to get home was to drive. So along with my counterpart from the Miami office, Dave Nelson, we rented a car left San Francisco midday on Friday. I walked in the door of my home in New Jersey Monday afternoon. On our best day, we did 1,020 miles. And if you ever have to drive cross-country, I recommend doing it with Dave Nelson. And those who know him know what I'm talking about. Annette, could you talk about how you learned the news and what the initial reactions were that you dealt with?
Sure. I first heard about the first plane hitting the World Trade Center from our Market Watch people, who I sat very close to. And that is often the case. If there's an event of any sort, they will come right in and tell us. They urged me to turn on the television so that I could see firsthand what they had viewed. That was for the first plane, and obviously it was pretty dramatic. But my first thought was that I'd better go and tell the chairman, but and I'm ashamed to say this in front of Harvey, but before I did, I hesitated and called my husband, but let the record show that that was the first call into the Federal Reserve, letting them know what had happened. I then went to the chairman's office and informed Harvey and his staff, and we were watching the television as the second plane hit, and obviously it was very clear that we had a very serious event on our hands. Our first thought then was to obviously go right back to Market Reagan, start marshaling the troops and addressing the issue by putting together a plan to contact people at all of the major firms and the markets in New York to see, you know, what the situation was, what was the status of the markets and the safety of the people, and we did that, you know, immediately. In addition, we obviously had to address the concerns about our own staff. We had a number of people who were extremely concerned and eager to leave and go home to their families. That was even more so after it became clear that the Pentagon had been hit, and it was, I must say, extremely difficult to stay focused when we were aware that there was yet another plane purportedly on its way to Washington, and it was unclear to us where it was headed. I was pretty sure it would not be headed for the SEC. I wasn't so sure it wouldn't be headed for Treasury or the White House or the Fed, so it was a little hairy for a while, and certainly very difficult for everybody to deal with. We, as I said, came up with a plan, obviously with the help of the chairman and his staff as well, to deal with the issues, including immediately putting in place a plan to meet with the major markets and the market participants the next day in New York. This required quite a bit of coordination, because obviously just getting to New York, getting down to the New York Stock Exchange and meeting with Chairman Grasso was no mean feat given what was going on at the time in New York. But so we coordinated with various federal and state agencies. We were able to do that, and obviously and I can talk later about what followed from that, but it was I think a really wonderful coordinated effort on the part of the markets, the market participants, state and federal authorities, Con Ed, Verizon, and various other people who got together and sort of worked through what I'd call a market-driven response to this terrible event. So with that, I'll turn it over to Ed.
Well, really, to set the stage for the stock exchange, we had our enforcement division at World Trade Center Tower Number 2, and you may remember that there was a bombing there several years before, and the criticism of the Port Authority was that, well, among many, was that they didn't have any lights in the stairwells when people were trying to go down, and they didn't have any form of communications to the people who were in the building to know what was going on. I got a call from Sal Plante, who said he could see that World Trade Center, one of the towers, was burning. So I called Dave Daugherty, who is head of our enforcement division, and asked what was happening, and he said, well, the building now had an intercom system, and over the intercom system they were telling people, just go back to your office, there's nothing to worry about, that there's a fire in the other building and we have it entirely under control. While I was speaking to him, the other plane hit the building, and luckily they hit before 9 o'clock. Now, I don't want to say that our folks didn't get in early to work, but a lot of folks had actually not gotten up in the elevators in the World Trade Center, which was great. We told Dave, one, obviously we didn't have to tell him to get everybody out of the building as fast as possible, and to get everybody to the extent he could over to the exchange, because we were concerned about the people and knowing where they were, and we wanted to be able to corral as many people as we could and keep them there until the perceived danger passed. A large number of people did show up at the exchange from our Division of Enforcement, and we had about two-thirds of all of the people there. We then, while we were still in the building, although lots of phones didn't work, some cell phones did work, some cell phones didn't work, we were able to contact a number of the people who had gone to their homes from the office or gone to their parents' homes. And we'll get into later, there were a number of people that we couldn't track down, and we didn't know what happened to them. When the second tower collapsed, it was like an earthquake in our building, even though we're about four blocks away, and we didn't exactly know what happened, but a couple of seconds later, the air turned black, and you couldn't see outside the building, and so we kept everybody there until 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, to the extent that they would stay. They weren't under house arrest, but we strongly suggested that they do that. Then people started to walk home. You might have heard of one woman who actually was our assistant corporate secretary picked up a couple of kids from a nursing school where the teacher was trying to corral all these little kids to get them away from the center, left her name with the teacher and took the kids home and then delivered them to the parents later that night. We also had somebody, two of our enforcement people in Denver who immediately rented a car and drove through the night and to get back to the city so that they could be with their families. It wasn't they were trying to get to the exchange, for sure. And I think that that's really the human side of what we went through on that day, and there's certainly a lot more that we'll get into. Tom?
When the first plane hit, I was, as I do every morning, I was with my assistant, Cindy, for the last two decades, going through mail and stuff, and she said that must be a sonic boom. We were at the World Financial Center right immediately across the street. It seemed very, very loud, and then it was just a matter of time. A few people came into the office, and they said that the plane is going to be World Trade Center. So I went out, went to Dick Pohl's office, who was our chairman. He wasn't there. I believe he had a doctor's appointment at the time. So I went there, and most of the management of the firm were in his office, and we were actually watching the building burn. And we got Dick on the phone, and we were trying to discuss what should we do, because we had people already in the World Trade Center lower floors, and they were evacuating. We did that. The issue was, what do we do in our building? And so there was a lot of dialogue and a lot of feeling maybe we shouldn't be doing anything, because there'll be just bedlam out there, and I don't think anyone thought the building was going to fall. And we were actually looking at the building and physically saw the second plane come in and hit the building, the second building. And then we decided that we have to have an organized evacuation. We told that to Dick, and we did that. I was actually the last one to leave the building by the time, because I wanted to make sure everyone was out. When I left, the first building had already collapsed, and there's all this debris in the on the first floor of Three World Financial Center. And I remember thinking at the time, I mean, it seemed like something out of a war scene, because you had all this soot and everything all over the place, and it was all over you, and you're really at that point not sure, you know, where you are and what's happening. And it just seems like so. It was such a traumatic experience. And then we got out of the building, and we're standing around. Actually, I spent a lot of time with Dave Kamansky. We were talking about what to do and what does it all mean. And I was on my cell phone with Dick, our chairman, and we were just sort of disoriented in some ways because of the horror of it all. Oh, and one other point I should bring out, which is, I mentioned horror. I remember it very well. I remember looking out of his office when we were there, and I remember watching the people jump off the roof. I guess it was a two World Trade Center, and I remember just seeing it, and it was just the. You can imagine what they had to have been going through, the dilemma, and just seeing those people come down, and it's just something that, you know, you just never get out of your mind. Anyway, so I was down at the base on the phone with our chairman, trying to figure out what are we supposed to do. Several of the senior management wound up getting on a ferry to go over to Jersey immediately to go into our disaster recovery site, which is in Jersey City, 101 Hudson. Our chairman was midtown, and I was going to walk up to see him. And I remember, just on a personal side before we go into the business issue, I remember walking up, and my knees, which are terrible from running, were just agony. One of the policemen said, "You better go faster, because the pavement underneath may explode. They smelled gas, and there were actually cars going the other way. Most of the fire trucks and everything were going towards the World Trade Center, but at one point there was a turning around. There was a feeling that it may explode, and I was thinking, you know, that it, that seemed very feasible, and I couldn't go any faster because my knees were just in agony at this point in time, and I remember thinking, should I jump into the river at this point? Because if it does explode, at least I have a chance of doing that. So I decided not to do that, and I finally went to Midtown. I remember one, it's in retrospect somewhat humorous, with all of this happening, Dick on the phone, not realizing some of it, particularly the gas, said, go back and then get a ferry to Jersey to our disaster recovery site. And I'm thinking to myself, go back, and I'm looking at the buildings, I'm looking at all of this, and I'm thinking, that doesn't seem like a good idea. And so, as usual, I did what I thought best, anyway, so I went, I spent time with him, and then we, from there, which is the next part of what we'll talk about, we had to figure out what to do with the firm and how to manage through it.
Thank you, Tom. In terms of getting things back up and running and performing our functions, we really started to turn to that very first day. You know, as I said, the focus was initially on tracking everyone down. But even as we did that, we started to get to work on getting ourselves in shape to continuing our functions. And as a regional office, of course, we had both an enforcement staff and an examination staff. One stroke of luck that we had was that on September 11th, there was a large contingent of Northeast Regional Office staff in Washington for the commission meeting that had been scheduled that for that day, because we had a number of enforcement recommendations on the calendar. And among the group down there was Mark Schoenfeld, who at the time was one of the co-heads of enforcement in the office. And Mark, since he was there in Washington, did a great deal in addressing a lot of the administrative aspects of getting us what we needed to get started again. We really had a monumental task in front of us. We had no office, no files, no computers, most abhorrent to a bunch of lawyers, no documents. It really didn't slow us down at all. Because a lot of people stepped forward, a lot of them on their own initiative, people from senior levels, people from junior levels, to do whatever they could do to get us going again. Groups of staff met in people's homes, met in people's apartments. Karen Pennington's in the audience. She was an assistant director in enforcement at the time. She had a meeting of the investigative team on a very important investigation in her apartment, and there ended up being a picture of that in the New York Times, which I felt was one of the best ways we could demonstrate that we weren't missing a beat. There was a group of staff who met in a public library out on Long Island, where a number of them lived. We even had one broker-dealer exam team that went back in the field, literally within a couple of days, to resume an exam. And not because someone directed them to do it, and it was the sort of thing that you just sort of hear about it, and it strikes you as it gives you an incredible sense of pride in what these people were doing. These are not people who had fancy titles, you know, examiners who were in the middle of conducting an exam. They thought what they were supposed to do was go back and resume their exam, so they did. And there were a lot of stories like that. We had very important assistance from our friends in the U.S. Attorney's offices in the Eastern District of New York and the Southern District of New York. They both gave us office space to work in, both on matters that we had in parallel with them and also matters that they didn't have any involvement in at all. They just gave us the assistance. We also got working right away on finding new office space. And that got started while I was still in San Francisco. There was a group that consisted of Leslie Kazon, who's also here today, Ed Nordlinger, and Richard Lee, who that later that first week toured around a number of sites to find suitable office space, and I did that as well when I got back. And this was at a point when the only way that you could enter Lower Manhattan was with a police escort, and the barriers were still up. It really felt like entering a war zone, and I remember in those circumstances going and visiting the Woolworth Building, which, as someone's mentioned already, is where we opened our new office. I don't know what exactly Chairman Pitt did, but whatever it was, it worked, because Jane Seidman appeared in New York fully empowered to cut through all imaginable red tape, bureaucratic requirements, you name it. If you think that federal agencies are unavoidably slow-moving, irretrievably bureaucratic, unable to make decisions, that is not what we experienced, and I know it was thanks to Harvey Pitt that happened. A process that normally would have at best taken months took a few days. We also got focused on recovering as much as we could of what had been lost, and we actually were able to recover almost all of our electronic documents, email and other electronic documents. It was heartening and a little surprising that we were able to recover as much as we did. We went to the court reporters to get replacements for the testimony transcripts we lost. We went to criminal prosecutors and SROs where there were parallel investigations to replace the documents we had lost. And when we had to, we went back to the people who had produced documents to us and asked them to produce them again. And we got very good cooperation in that regard. Roughly a couple of weeks after 9/11, we got some very generous assistance from Fordham Law School, which is in the Lincoln Center neighborhood here in Manhattan. They gave us an auditorium that was big enough to hold the whole Northeast Regional Office staff, and we passed the word through the phone trees because, of course, nobody was connected to email. And it was the first gathering of the entire staff, or close to the entire staff, and we had almost everybody there. Part of the purpose for that event was to deal with the human side of things and get people more reconnected. Mark Radke, who was Chairman Pitt's chief of staff, came down for that meeting. Laurie Richards, who has always had a lot of affection as well as respect for the exam staff here in New York, came to that meeting. There also was a very big practical component to that meeting, because there was some really phenomenal work by the IT staff in Washington. They showed up at Fordham Law School with over 200 laptop computers, many of which I believe were manufactured specifically to be brought to us. They handed out every one of them to members of the staff, which meant that even more of us could get more actively back to work, even still without an office. It meant everybody could connect into email remotely, and the whole office could be in touch. We reopened in the Woolworth Building on October 15th. We hit the ground running. We actually hit the ground running before that, because our first post 9/11 enforcement action was brought on September 28th. A case called In the Matter of David F. Bellett, which Karen Pennington will remember if no one else does, other than Mr. Bellett. We were back in action bringing more cases in October. After all was said and done, we were able to reconstruct really everything that was lost that mattered. The losses on 9/11 did not prevent us in New York from bringing any enforcement case that we felt warranted being brought. And in that connection, I would be remiss if I didn't also mention that the response of the defense bar and the industry who dealt with us in our enforcement matters. These were circumstances where you could imagine a person could be tempted to take advantage, and it didn't happen. When we asked people to give us the documents again, they did. When we when we contacted people and said we're ready to resume the settlement discussions we were in the middle of, they resumed them. There was only one exception that I heard about. There was only one apparent effort to take advantage of what had happened, a particular case where there, before 9/11, there had been an agreement in principle on settlement terms. And after 9/11, the prospective defendants backed out of the agreement in principle. And our suspicion was they thought that the case was small enough and difficult enough to reconstruct that we wouldn't do it. We did. We reconstructed the case, and we brought the case, and the case was settled. And I guess I would sum all of this up by saying that what I found, having gone through this experience with the really incredible staff of the Northeast Regional Office, was we never really lost the Northeast Regional Office of the SEC. We lost a physical location, and we lost some objects. But the office, which was the people, never missed a beat. And you know, Annette, if you could turn to the efforts to get the markets going.
That's hard to follow. I think, you know, what you've heard from Wayne really underscores what I think many of us at the commission who were there at the time feel, which is that, you know, it was really an amazing effort on everyone's part, and certainly under the leadership of Chairman Pitt, we were able to achieve things that, as a government agency, no one ever thought was possible. Really cutting through red tape, facilitating resolutions. I think the message really from the very top was that we were to do everything we could to engage in outreach with the markets and with industry participants, with our fellow government agencies, and do everything that we could to really further what was our sort of national mission at that time, and to restore the markets and restore investor confidence. Really, that day really the first moments, you know, Chairman Pitt was you know, drafting a statement to the public about the situation, advising the public of our support for the markets and for the closing of the markets, and our confidence that, you know, we would continue to monitor the situation and that we would keep the public well informed. And that really is, you know, the most important thing that you can do in a time like that, is to keep the lines of communication open, to let people know that you're on the case, and that they will be, you know, informed as things develop. We did spend a huge amount of time on communication with the markets, with market participants, with the President's Working Group, which really was the President's Working Group on Financial Markets was a wonderful means of facilitating dialogue among the SEC, CFTC, the Federal Reserve, and the Treasury, and there were telephonic meetings regularly, sometimes more than once a day, keeping each other informed about the situation and what our efforts were to assist. We, as I said earlier, had agreed to go to meetings in New York and to assess the situation with a large group, including, you know, again, representatives from the governor's office, the mayor's office, Con Ed, Verizon, FEMA, again, the markets, market participants, clearing agencies, major banks, the Federal Reserve of New York. It was critically important that that the response to this crisis be something that there was consensus on, that the market participants felt comfortable with, you know, with their decisions on closing the markets and when they should be reopened, and we wanted to be there, you know, supporting them, and also obviously to be comfortable with their decisions. Connectivity was sort of the
the major problem at that time, as you can imagine. It was a significant concern that even markets like New York that could have opened didn't have connectivity with the firms that it does business with. And also there was the overriding concern about the rescue efforts and personnel safety concerns that caused the market participants to determine to close the markets and to wait until the next Monday to reopen. It also, because of the connectivity and other issues, gave us all the time to test for connectivity, not only to restore connectivity, but to test for connectivity over the weekend to ensure that when the markets came up, they stayed up. And that was a very critical concern on everyone's part. We felt that if the markets came back up and then failed because of connectivity issues, that would have a very detrimental impact on investor confidence. And so it was really incumbent on us to make sure that we got it right from the beginning. And so I think, you know, in retrospect, that was a very smart move. The Treasury market and the futures markets opened on Thursday, so they were closed on Wednesday and reopened on Thursday, and that was a successful operation as well.
Annette, did you know for sure that everything was going to work when it started up, or was there some doubt until it actually happened?
I think we were pretty confident because we had our automation review policy group, our ARP group, working with liaising with the firms and with the New York Stock Exchange. We had large groups of people from OC as well who do this work over the weekend, and we had a high degree of confidence. I think one of our concerns was just that we didn't know what the volume would be, and particularly if there was a huge influx of sell orders, whether we'd end up with issues because of overwhelming the system. So there was a little bit of concern on that part, but I think we felt that if it was anywhere within the normal range, that we were pretty comfortable that that it would work, and or if there were problems, that they would be isolated problems and that we would be able to deal with them. And I think there may have been some problems, but they were very small and very isolated. So again, the equity and options trading resumed on September 17th. There were some issues, though. As you know, the American Stock Exchange did have suffered damage to their building, and they were not able to operate in that building. And one of the things that I remember most about this period was the overwhelming cooperation among the markets and market participants, people who normally were arch rivals in terms of or arch competitors, couldn't do enough for each other to help out. And in the case of the American Stock Exchange, both the New York Stock Exchange and the Philadelphia Stock Exchange assisted by providing technology and space for traders to, you know, resume trading on Monday in on those other markets. And obviously we responded by doing whatever we needed to do from a regulatory standpoint to make sure that worked as well. Another thing that I think we're all quite proud of in retrospect, and again, this was something that Chairman Pitt was very instrumental in doing, was the outreach included our going to SIA and the Bond Market Association and asking what relief would be helpful to the markets and to market participants when the markets reopened. Was there anything that, and obviously, you know, we couldn't guarantee that all requests would be honored, but that certainly they were in a better position than we were to anticipate what type of regulatory relief might be useful. And this was the first time we used our Section 12K authority, our emergency authority, to effect, you know, rule changes or temporary rule changes on an emergency basis. And there was a fairly extensive list of actions that we took, all of which I think were recommended, you know, to us by the various industry groups. And I think they really were very well advised and very helpful, and we've certainly have kept track of them for hopefully future reference that we'll never need. But we did things, for instance, as you know, the 10B18 relief that we gave, so that there was a concern that, again, with a lot of potential panic selling when the markets reopened on September 17th, a number of issuers said that they wanted to show their confidence in the markets by being able to repurchase their own shares at levels that weren't restricted by the 10B18 safe harbor limits, and in fact wanted to, if to the extent possible, to be in the markets early in the day so that you didn't have this sort of panic selling and then you'd see a huge market decline, you know, right out of the open. So one of the things we did was we had temporary changes to 10B18 that permitted issuers to be in, you know, in the markets at the open and at the close, and dramatically increased the volume limits to 100% of the average daily trading volume instead of, I think, 25%. We had other changes as well. As you know, there were problems with clearance and settlement of government securities, to say the least. And as a result, there were a number of firms that, because of these clearance problems, and again, these were aberrational. These weren't problems that we thought represented permanent issues. You know, they would have caused gigantic capital charges to the firms that were really not representative of the actual financial conditions at the time. And so we suspended calculating the charges on those government positions that clearly were unable to settle because of the problems with the clearing banks. There were a number of firms who lost physical securities or had records that were lost, and they needed to try to recover those records, and they wanted to go to outside accounting firms to get help doing that. And technically doing that might have violated the independence rules. Well, obviously that wasn't the time to be worrying about independence rules, and so we you know, gave relief on that as well. There were a number of investment management, you know, mutual fund exemptions that we gave. Obviously, things like telephonic meetings that should certainly have been permitted during a time like this, or borrowing from affiliates. There was a lot of concern in the markets about liquidity. I mean, not only did, obviously, the Federal Reserve you know, provide substantial liquidity in the markets, we tried to do what we could consistent with those goals by ensuring that in this crisis period, that, you know, borrowing from affiliates, those kinds of transactions that are normally precluded, could be, you know, would be permissible during this time. So there really were you know, a number of actions that we took, and I think in retrospect, you know, they really worked quite well. And I do think that you know, one of the lessons from all this was really just how a coordinated effort, that kind of outreach, that service-oriented approach during a time like this served us very, very well.
Just as Wayne said, we tried to get our enforcement group together as soon as we could. Luckily, we had a floor in 20 Broad, which is right next to our building, that we were going to put technology people in. So the floor was fully wired, and within a week, we had our enforcement division up and running. We did tell people if they didn't want to come in, they didn't have to for some period of time. Everyone but one person came in, and that person eventually left the exchange because they didn't want to be downtown. We could understand that. What we found, the police and emergency management and the other state and city groups were terrific, and they got all of the senior people at the exchange in every day right after the 11th. And one of the things that we found the first day we were back is that the phones were ringing all over the floor of the exchange, and we couldn't quite figure out who the hell was calling us. And it turns out those were all dedicated lines, and when the other side of the line was essentially done away with, all of those phones were ringing. As Annette said, we met with Verizon and with Con Ed, and it turns out that although most of the firms were sure that they had dual access, dual lines running through every place. Well, I don't know if this had anything to do with the WorldCom problem or not, but telephone firms were trading space on the lines among one another, and it turned out that almost all of the lines went through West Street, the Verizon West Street building, which happens to be right next to 7 World Trade Center. And when 7 World Trade Center went down, beams and other things pierced the Verizon building, and at the same time water main broke, which evidently they have 5 basements where all of the switches, and the water was up to the 3rd basement level, so that Verizon people were literally risking their lives to try to not get electrocuted at the same time trying to restore telephone service. Whereas Con Ed said that for the first time in the history of Lower New York, there are 7 lines that come down to Lower Manhattan. 5 of those lines were out. The only way they could restore service was to lay 135,000 volt lines directly on the street, which they did, and those of us who were downtown at that point saw that they had little paper things over the line saying high voltage. And then they would run 13,500 volt lines off of that cable into the buildings. But they were, and they couldn't get to all of the buildings, so what they asked us was which buildings had our member firms in them, and we were able to give them a list of those buildings, and so those buildings got their service restored before the other buildings, which was tremendously helpful in getting up the market up and running. Every day that we came in that week, we were at least evacuated once. And the word was that One Liberty Plaza was falling down. So One Liberty Plaza was falling down just about every day in the afternoon. So they'd get all of us out of the building, and we'd have to go to 30 Broad Street to be protected. Then about a half hour later, they'd decide it wasn't falling down, and we'd come back in. One of those days, someone said, One Liberty Plaza is falling, and they told the truck driver who was in the street, had one of those big long trucks, so he got out of his truck and ran away, and which caused a riot because now there was this big truck that there was nobody there right in the middle of the Wall Street area. So that took about 2 hours to get that guy back and find out what the hell was going on. We were able during that week, as Annette said, to be able to talk to the commission, to be able to talk to all the other markets that and the member firms to see where we are, where they were with getting up their connectivity. And it wasn't only connectivity to the exchange. Those firms in Lower Manhattan didn't have any connectivity to their customers. So Goldman Sachs couldn't reach out to its customers. So to open the markets before firms were able to get to their customers and get to us didn't seem to make a hell of a lot of sense. We actually did have dual lines, and we had dual sites, and so our stuff actually was up and running all of the time. But it didn't make any difference if we were open if nobody came to the party. And that was a lot of the discussions that we had during that week were, when were people going to be up and ready so that trading could begin? With respect to the Amex, they came and said they couldn't open, that they couldn't get into their building, because both the New York Stock Exchange and the American Stock Exchange own SIAC. We both came, used the same system, and we, the New York Stock Exchange, had sold the Amex our specialist book, you know, that they used to trade. So if they came into our market and we presented our screens, it wouldn't look foreign to the Amex specialist. And we reached agreement that they could have every single stock trade. We have, for those of you who know the exchange, they have several rooms, and one of the rooms is called the Expanded Blue Room because it's blue. And it's an expansion of another blue room. And so, and we had actually been cutting down on space, and so we had two posts that we were not using. And so the Amex, we told them they could bring as many people as they think they needed to run their market, which they did. They had a whole lot of stocks on each book, but, you know, frankly, their volume is not so great that that made a market that they couldn't handle. And so I think that it went off extraordinarily well. I think they were there a couple of weeks, and then they were able to get back into their building and continue trading. One of the things that Annette did mention, which was another great help on the capital area, was three firms had vaults in the World Trade Center, and several billions of dollars of securities were destroyed. And insurance companies wouldn't give a blanket bond to the firm, so they had to work it by security, and they would have been required to take 100% haircut on those, and one firm had $9 billion of security, so it would have been a big hit, and the commission was terrific in working with us and the firms and not having them take a haircut and working through that so that the firms could finally make all of their customers whole. They worked it out. They were able to figure out which securities were in those vaults, and nobody lost any money that I know of, and the firms did not have to stop operations. We, the New York Stock Exchange, got permission from the exchange not to examine certain members that year. You know, the SROs have a cycle of firms that they're going to examine, and there were certain firms that were still up and running, but their main office was in the World Trade Center, and we just didn't think that it was in anybody's best interest to run in there and do an examination of those firms. And so the commission gave us a pass on doing those firms. And so I thought that all in all, it was a tremendous effort on everybody's part. Everybody was working together, and I think we had a terrific outcome. It's true, debt started trading before equities, and that was sort of decided at the first meeting that we had, which, by the way, was at Bear Stearns. But they forgot to tell everybody when the hell I was supposed to settle. So some mm-hmm. people thought there was 1-day settlement, other people thought it was 3-day settlement, and some people thought it was 5-day settlement. So you can imagine what happened to a very, very large market when people weren't matching up in the settlement of those trades. And again, the commission was great in working through that, not requiring that charges be taken right away.
Ed, were there any instances of relief or accommodation that you wanted to get from the commission that you weren't able to get?
No, I think that 10b-18 was a huge deal for investor confidence of the people in the marketplace, and I think that was the major thing when that word went out and the companies felt that they could step in and buy their stock if they needed to, as it turned out, although that was the biggest volume day in the history of the New York Stock Exchange, it went extraordinarily well. And so we didn't need any extra, nor did the specialist or any of the member firms need any extra help in getting the market going and keeping it on an even keel.
Tom, please tell us about getting up and running at Lehman Brothers.
Well, it was real feat because we had our whole building. We couldn't go back in it, and so we were basically at Jersey City, and I remember right after the event, I spent the rest of the day on September 11th with our chairman trying to figure out what an agenda should be to put a firm back together again. And we had a disaster recovery plan. Unfortunately, I left it in the building, as luck would have it. So I had to go by memory. But we did have a disaster recovery site, and it was so we were in relatively speaking, good shape. So the first thing we had to do was worry about our people. It turned out that we did have a loss of one person, but we thought it might have been a lot worse. But we didn't know that it was only, oh, and I say only, but it was one person until many days later, because it was very, very hard to get in touch. That was one, we'll get to it later, one of the many lessons learned from this about how to get in touch with people. We tried to make some initial assessment that day about what the damage was done and whether or not we would be able to go back in business at any time, and what the issues were. Part of the problem was we had a lot of stuff on our computer, computers as opposed to in a distributed system. You might have things on individual computers, and another one of the many lessons learned, and we didn't know how important that would be in resuming trading, because so much of trading is off metrics, and so much of that metrics might have been embedded in those programs and individual PCs. So that was an issue we talked about. And then I was asked to set the agenda for our management committee meeting that next morning. I remember, since didn't have the luxury of getting things typed or anything, I remember writing out an agenda to restart a major U.S. investment bank. And I was thinking, I never learned anything about this in law school. But the first item on the agenda was the people, and that was our biggest concern. And we were worried about not only finding them, but we were worried about all the psychological damage that might have been caused. And I remember also thinking, including myself, then our issues were also what to do with those people, because the space at our disaster recovery site would only hold so many people. And one of the great things about 9/11 is that people really wanted to work. They just didn't want to be at home. They wanted to participate. And so we had a problem with many more people wanting to participate. So we had to go and figure out who was absolutely essential to the starting of a firm. And so we narrowed that down to relatively few people. Versus the entire body, and then we had to figure out where those other people were going to be stationed. And so we had to rent places and rooms all over the city and all over Jersey, even to the extent that we basically rented out the entire Sheraton Hotel on 7th Avenue. We threw out the beds. We made them into offices. We did a lot of very, I think, unique things. The first day, our biggest issue, aside from the people, was the computer infrastructure. We had facilities at our disaster recovery, but they were not anywhere near enough to get started if we were going to resume trading. So we had to buy computer equipment all over, wherever we can find it, and we put all the pressure we possibly could on every vendor imaginable. We got the stuff shipped overnight in every way. We had one of the members of our executive committee got a bus and took people across the country from California, but we managed to get the computer equipment in. We ripped the whole place apart to put in an awful lot of trading equipment, and because we wanted to be ready for trading. Our biggest issue in retrospect was not the fact that we didn't have the computers and all of that. Our biggest issue was the clearing firms and the government's security side. We were very concerned about that. The amount of fails, I remember it was so astronomical, the amount of fails, and I couldn't imagine numbers that large. I'd never seen them in my life, numbers that large. And but we were worried about the clearing firm, and we're very worried about Carnet and the ability to have electricity. We're very worried about the telephone service. But as far as the firm itself, after a couple of days, we felt fairly good. We would have huge checklists for each of the divisions and things that had to be done and testing of those. And as time went on, those checklists would get filled. And the checklists would be put on blackboards because this was hardly the time to get fancy. And so I remember when the equities trading floor, we had this huge checklist of things and where we are in them, what have you. It would be color-coded for where we needed to put the emphasis and what have you. So that was all done. It was around the clock. A great many people didn't get any sleep for 48 hours or more, including myself. It just had to be done, so we just did it. One of the amazing things about that period, certainly that first week, was that you didn't have to tell anyone to do anything. There were people who were relatively low level in the firm who just did it, and we didn't frankly give a damn about what it cost. It was not an issue, but people did it. They were incredibly creative. It reminded me of what it must have been like in World War II with some of our GIs and how creative they were when tanks broke down and what have you, and they just managed to fix things because they had to, and they did. But that was a remarkable thing. There was no bureaucracy, and no one gave a damn about, you know, just do it and get it done. So that was very inspiring. There were a lot of people who weren't allowed to work because we didn't have the space, and they were. We had to deal with that. The one humorous thing that came to mind at our original headquarters in the morning, we had this fellow named Donald who had worked for Lehman forever, and he would go around and he would give us coffee or something like that. It was like a nice frill, but he was really a really classy guy. And here we're in this disaster recovery site. Everyone's sweating, the place smelled. And Donald, on his own, went out. He would buy donuts, and he was the classiest guy at the place, you know, and we had a bit of class in a otherwise dismal surrounding. As far as the SEC went, I remember one talk with Annette, because I'm Catholic and I'm guilty about everything, and I said, you know, I just want you to know, I think if there's, I don't know how many record-keeping rules there are, but I'm sure we're violating more than there are. And so I got an oral no-action letter. She said, ah, forget it. And ultimately, there was a more formal codification of the oral position. But it's to think about worrying about these things at that time was almost humorous, because we were worried about the livelihood of the industry. The meetings we had several meetings with essentially the SEC and all other regulators, including the Fed. And I want to say, I mean, I thought Harvey's leadership in that is nothing short of remarkable, because a regulator is going to give the tone. And I think everyone in that room, and I was certainly in the room during all of these meetings, everyone felt that the only thing we wanted to do was get up as soon as we possibly could. But when we got up, we wanted to do it right. We knew we had to make a statement to the world that we were going to start this financial market soon as possible, that you cannot get in our way. We also knew that once you make that statement, you have to make it 100%. So the decision to do the Thursday opening of the debt market and the Monday opening of equity was very, very important. We debated whether we should do the equity Thursday or Friday, or do it Monday, and I think that was a very wise decision to do it Monday. We would have been prepared, I think, ourselves for Friday, but I think the problem was that there's too much connectivity, too many connectivity issues, and it would not have made it. So I think the partnership between government and and industry was never better. One of the things we did do is we moved a considerable amount. We had, fortunately, we had the ability to move a lot of trading activity to London, and not quite by flipping a switch, but we did do that, so we were very fortunate in that. And we took some gambles in terms of getting the distributed systems out of our Three World Financial Center. The reason why we couldn't go in there was because of asbestos. And I remember thinking it would shortcut a lot of things if we can get some of the key distributive systems out. And I remember talking to our head of internal audit at the time, Donahue, and I said someone has to go in to get that stuff out. And we looked around, and Ed was the most junior person there. He's looking around. and there was no one else, but we wound up getting suits and getting some of those systems out, and that was extraordinarily helpful. And bottom line is that we all got started with actually, you know, when you look at everything that happened with minimal disruption, when we needed space, and I just wanted to underscore one thing, people were volunteering space to us. It was not, in some cases, we didn't ask, and they asked us, and it was a remarkable time when an industry and indeed a country got together, and everyone made it happen as a group, and it was, in some sense, really was our finest hour, and we all did it together, and that made us a little bit better.
Thank you, Tom. We'll turn back to Annette now to start the discussion of lessons learned from this crisis and the process of coping with the crisis. Annette.
I think the biggest lesson that we learned was how dependent we are on the integrity of our system's infrastructure. And certainly since 9/11, we have spent more time on systems infrastructure and business continuity issues than ever before. You know, just stepping back for a minute, one of the things that it turned out we were just very fortunate about was that our ability to communicate not only with firms that didn't have to vacate their buildings, but with critical people in firms that did have to go to their backup sites, was that we had all of those numbers, and it was only because we had done it for the year 2000 changeover. So we had all of this information that we had put together for that event, and it turned out to be absolutely critical because, as I say, the communications were very robust, but it really was because we were, you know, we had this data. So one of the things that we learned, and again, the industry groups have been helpful in facilitating, is that we must keep updated, you know, records of not only firms' primary sites, but backup sites and backup communications issues and the like. Again, even within the Division of Market Regulation, we formed a new unit that deals with business continuity. So not only does it have our automation review policy people in it and the market watch people, but we have folks who devote their time to these business continuity issues, focusing on a number of the efforts to ensure that you know, critical market participants such as the, you know, exchanges and the clearing agencies and the large firms, you know, that everyone is addressing their crisis management issues, both in enhancing their communications and their decision-making processes and their backup facilities. One of the things that we did in April of 2003 was we issued jointly with the Federal Reserve and the Control of the Currency and the New York State Banking Department a white paper on business continuity that talked about disaster recovery standards for systemically critical financial market, financial sector participants. And the focus on that was on the core payment and clearance and settlement organizations. And the decision was made that they needed to have the capability to recover their critical operations within 2 hours of a major, a wide-scale disruption along the lines of September 11th. And in addition, we determined that the significant firms that handle more than 5% of the volume in critical markets should be able to be to recover within 4 hours of such an event. Now, that's easier said than done. So you can imagine that since that white paper was issued, that there's been a huge amount of effort that's gone into trying to ensure that these critical market participants can meet those standards. And obviously, it's not only a huge management issue, but a huge financial issue and a financial commitment for these critical market participants to meet these standards. The Commission has also done a policy statement on market reopenings. We've indicated that the SRO markets and the ECNs should have the capacity to resume trading on a next-day basis following a wide-scale disruption. And again, there's been a huge effort that's gone into helping the markets meet those goals. We also now have something that we never had before, backup contingency plans for the New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ. Each of those markets, you may not be aware, is prepared to trade the other's securities. And there was some work, coding and otherwise, that needed to be done to ensure that if you had a situation in the future where one of those markets went down and the other didn't, that one could trade the securities of the other. Obviously, since the time of that agreement, I think we've seen our markets move even to an even more electronic platforms, and you know, it may well be that the more electronic, I do think the more electronic these markets are, the less we're dependent on floor-based trading, the more likely you'll be able to conduct trading by having backup electronic facilities elsewhere. We also have approved SRO rules that require their member firms to have business continuity plans. And we continue to work closely with, you know, the President's Working Group on Financial Markets to ensure, and with Homeland Security and other government agencies to ensure that, you know, we continue our focus on business continuity. You know, one thing along the lines of what Tom was talking about, I mean, there's no question that, you know, September 11th was a very difficult time for all, but I would say that everyone I worked with during that time really stepped up to the challenge and had a commitment not only, you know, for themselves and their organizations, but really for the nation as a whole as well. I mean, in our own division of market regulation, and people obviously work, you know, nonstop trying to do what we could to get the markets up. Chairman Pitt had asked for volunteers, I think, to come to New York to have representatives of the SEC at each of the major firms and the markets just to be there if people had questions on September 17th when the markets came up. We had hotlines that you know, dedicated lines for investors and for market participants to be able to call directly in to get questions answered immediately. The only problems we had in market reg was you know, deciding who to choose among the volunteers. I mean, it was really quite gratifying. You know, our view was that we really didn't lose much time in keeping up with our regular work as well, because the people who were not dedicated to working on the 9/11 issues were taking on the task of doing the routine work that some of the people who had volunteered on 9/11 issues were working on. So, you know, again, it really was an incredible time for all of us, and it was an honor to work through these issues with all the people that we did.
Annette, looking back with all you know now, is there anything that in retrospect you would have done differently in the aftermath of 9/11?
Well, I do think it went well. I think we are a little more organized now, obviously, in terms of our own preparedness as well, not only with SEC systems backups, which, you know, were not challenged, obviously, at the time, but also with clearer demarcations of responsibilities and knowing, you know, who would go to our backup centers and, you know, who would stand in the district and the like. But, you know, all in all, I think we did pretty well. I'm not sure I'd do too much differently.
Ed, from the stock exchange and more generally the SRO perspective, what lessons do you draw?
I think the first thing that Tom has touched on it is that we built a system so that we could actually find out where our people are if we need them. And we built a security system so that they could get in, but we found that telephone was not an adequate way to get to people or for people to get to the exchange to find out what's going on. So the exchange built secret extranet that its employees could get to with specific codes to get into that so that the exchange could reach those employees and the employees can reach the exchange, and that was extremely important. The exchange also built a dual trading site somewhere out there in this world. There is another place that if the building at 11 Wall went down that the specialists could go and trade, and all stocks could trade, and all members that are currently on the floor could go to that space and trade there. They also built something that they call safety, which is a real dual system so that it doesn't run through the telephone tunnels, so that if something happens to the telephone lines, that this second line is separate and apart, and we left it open to any member firm that wants to join it, to banks that want to join it, to whether the Fed wants to join it, so there would be a secure second route for connectivity to get into the exchange. And that just throughout, you know, the New York Stock Exchange can trade NASDAQ stocks, and NASDAQ could trade New York Stock Exchange. So, well, you think, Christ, NASDAQ does that now. Well, that's not the plan. That NASDAQ trades New York Stock Exchange stocks as if they were on the New York Stock Exchange. The plan that NASDAQ wanted was to trade NASDAQ stocks as if they were on NASDAQ, and our plan was to trade NASDAQ stocks as if they were on the New York Stock Exchange. Well, that seems easy, except that it turns out that the firms couldn't report 1, 2, or 3 letter symbols if they were NASDAQ market makers, so that they couldn't report that. And our member firms couldn't report 4 and 5 letter symbols trading if they were trading on the exchange. And so actually it was a fairly big lift for the firms to change their systems so that they could in fact trade those if they needed to, whether it was electronic or not electronic. It wasn't so much the markets, but it was the market participants being able to clear and settle the trades, get them into the tape. The tape vendors on the New York Stock Exchange tapes, we can't put up 5-letter symbols on the New York Stock Exchange tape, so you can't trade them. And for a while, NASDAQ thought they would put an X in front of all of our stocks, and if it was a 3-letter symbol, and if it was a 1-letter symbol, they'd get 3 X's. Then they thought what 3 X's meant, and they probably that wasn't really a great idea. But all of those things have gotten worked out. Hopefully, they'll never have to be used. But those were sort of the major things that we did to make sure that we in the securities industry would be up and running, and we could take care of our people, and they would know what was going on.
Same question to you, Ed. Looking back, is there anything you would have done differently?
Well, clearly we would have done a better job of knowing where our people were, because that was the first thing that we were worried about. And, you know, people left town, they went to their country houses, and we didn't have their numbers or their parents or someplace else. And somebody in a meeting I had this morning was saying that were talking about people. And he said someone told him that it's not the people who pay you that you should worry about, it's the people you pay. And we think that that's right. The markets run on the people. The infrastructure really is a secondary thing.
Tom, from the industry perspective, what lessons do you draw?
Well, just an awful lot. I mean, first, if you start with the people now, there's just so many more ways to reach people now. I was just going through my wallet, just some of the things that just came out. Who's Bubbles? Oh, excuse me. Sorry. We have cards of the key people, work numbers, what have you. GETS, which is a federal government emergency system, so that when the phones aren't working, at least you have an emergency system that you can get through. All of the senior people now, the senior management, we have, aside from having several cell phones, have satellite phones, which we're supposed to keep in certain places and what have you. We have an incredible system of finding people now, and we test it, and we have call trees and everything, and it's supposed to be updated every whatever couple of months with every possible number on it. So just in that one aspect, which was a real disaster, we're just 100% better. But then if you go down every other aspect, just in data centers, for example, we have a data center in 10th Avenue in New York, but then we have another one in Livingston, New Jersey. We're so we have so many redundancies now that we didn't have before. So in the protecting of the data, we were very, very, very fortunate in the sense that that 9/11, it all happened in the morning. Frankly, if it would have happened to us in the middle of the day, I don't know where we would be today. So it would have been a much harder job. That's not really a problem today, I think, because the data leaves our building immediately and gets backed up, so it's a huge difference there. In terms of just the security, just physical security to get in to do damage in our building would be, very, very, very hard for someone. We got guards in the front, we have turnstiles they have to go through, they need cards, and then there's several checkpoints, and any baggage for any guest has to get go through an inspection, so it was anything like that before. So I think we've gone from, this industry has gone very, 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 very far from where we were. I think the main issue, though, that remains is that, like in most crises, we sort of solved for what was, and the next crisis is normally very different. And I think the real challenge is to think of what it could be. It wouldn't surprise me that something like worms or something of that nature, where they go right into a computer system and totally, if that ever happened where we didn't have the filters to catch them and things of that nature, which is possible, those kinds of things would be very, very, very crippling. And so anything in that cyberspace is a, could be a problem. So I think that would, that to me would be, a big concern. I know we've now spent an awful lot of money trying to shore that aspect up because of my and others, people's fears that could be next. But I think from an industry point of view, we've taken the lessons learned, and the white paper was an excellent step for the whole industry to move forward. And it was another good example of an industry working with governments to make the financial services industry much, much, much stronger.
Thank you, Tom. I guess what I would add on the topic of lessons learned is an observation that's a little different in that all of these important observations and improvements and preparations for the marketplace and the markets are something that stay in our minds and are institutionalized and are established and maintained and improved over time. A lot of us who went back to work in Lower Manhattan shortly after 9/11. At the time, I think, had a very big lesson played out in front of ourselves, but unlike these others, it's one that I think has faded a lot with time and shouldn't fade. I remember when we were first in the Woolworth Building, this was right in the midst of the time of the anthrax scares that I'm sure everyone recalls took place shortly after 9/11, and there was the first week there was an incident in our offices where someone noticed some white powder, and people were in an incredibly high state of anxiety and concern. The experience of going to a part of Manhattan and feeling like you were in a war zone is the kind of thing that really shakes your frame of reference. Putting that together with the anthrax scares, putting that together with the acrid aroma that was in the air in Lower Manhattan in those weeks, a lot of us in the office as well as other people who were working in Lower Manhattan in those weeks were coughing and having sore throats and other symptoms which we knew were the result of what we were breathing that was part of the aftermath of 9/11. And putting all that together, I remember thinking at the time, are we ever going to have the kind of feeling of safety and security that we all have always taken for granted in this country, going through that sort of shakes your perception that wars and large scale attacks take place in other parts of the world, but not here. I think that to a great degree, our sense of safety and security has returned in these years since 9/11. In a lot of ways, we're more alert. We go through more security when we go into buildings, but I think a lot of that has faded. So the lesson I try to preserve is to try not to take for granted what we have in this country and in the society, because that was something that was really very dramatically played out for us in the weeks after 9/11. That concludes our panel. I'll turn it back over to Bob Coopers.
Let's thank our panel for their insights. Wayne, Annette, Ed, and Tom, thank you very much. As the 26th chairman of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, Harvey L. Pitt led the SEC's response to the market disruptions resulting from the attacks on September 11th. Today, he is chief executive officer of Kalorama Partners, LLC, a global business consulting firm. He was a senior corporate and securities partner at Fried Frank, Harris Shriver, and Jacobson prior to becoming SEC chairman, and served as the SEC's general counsel in the 1970s. The SEC Historical Society will forever be grateful to Harvey as a founding trustee of the society and as our first president. Harvey's service and dedication to the SEC spans several decades, and his leadership of the agency in its hour of greatest crisis is an indelible part of the Commission's history. It's my privilege to welcome Harvey Pitt to present the concluding address of our annual meeting.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. as I'm fond of noting, you've just seen empirical evidence why I'd rather be introduced by good friends than members of Congress. I'm pleased and honored to be back at Bear Stearns today as the Historical Society holds its 2005 annual meeting here in my city of origin, New York. The SEC, as most of you know, is an agency for which I've unabashedly had a great deal of affection for nearly 40 years since I began my legal career there. And the Historical Society, which commemorates the agency's illustrious history, is also near and dear to my heart. I think most of you know that the Society came to life under the patient and nurturing care of former SEC Chairman David Reuter, who served as the Society's first chairman. David is a very special person and a dear friend, and he deserves a place of honor in the annals of the SEC's historical saga. And so it was fitting that he was the first chairman of the Society. Since then, David has relinquished the reins to Ted Levine and Bob Kippers. The Society has continued to evolve and flourish, and now even has an actual bank balance filling its coffers, which I find impressive. And of course, it goes without saying that the credit for the Historical Society's terrific growth and its great accomplishments are due in no small measure to the efforts of Carla Rosati, its first and only executive director. Now, the last time that I was physically at Bear Stearns, a scant 45 months ago, its then auditorium served as the locus for a joint press conference conducted by the heads of the NYSE and NASDAQ, Peter Fisher of the Treasury Department, and me, to report on our first day of deliberations regarding the reopening of the nation's equity markets in the aftermath of those hideous terrorist attacks. Today, I think it's important that the Society is devoting this annual meeting to recalling the events of 9/11 and the SEC's role, among others, in addressing those events. Given the impressive panel discussion you've just heard, I'm afraid that this so-called keynote address is at best redundant. The people from whom you've just heard had to eat, drink, and breathe the consequences of 9/11. They were and they are in the best position to tell you and posterity what really happened after our equity markets went down, and how we were all able to respond. So I will try to just share with you some of my impressions and recollections of those terrible and yet rewarding days. And then if we have some time, maybe if there are any questions, I'd be happy to try and respond to them. Tacitus, the Roman historian, once observed that history's highest function is to let no worthy action go uncommemorated, while at the same time holding out the possibility of reprobation by posterity to discourage evil words and evil deeds. And so I guess even back then, historians recognized that worthy actions and evil deeds were flip sides of the same coin. It's clear that those who rose to the occasion of 9/11 deserve commemoration. Unfortunately, those who inflicted the evil deeds weren't deterred by their assumption of history's stinging judgment of their behavior. I think, in fact, they were counting on it. But unlike those who say we can never learn from history, I think we must, and 9/11 is a paradigm of how a crisis could and should be handled, and how we benefit from history reminding us of what went wrong, but also what went right. In doing this, it's somewhat unfortunate that we reopen old wounds, but that, of course, is the process of the science of history. They say time heals all wounds, and I suppose time will tell whether that's even possible with respect to 9/11. But just as Wayne was indicating, a part of me hopes that it really isn't possible. I think we have to remember and feel the anguish and pain that we all suffered that terrible day and the days thereafter in order to avoid repeating the causes that led to those dastardly acts. So for me here with you, almost 4 years later, it's still chilling to recall the events of September 11th and their aftermath. I guess as someone once observed, in this life, we encounter hurts and trials we won't be able to change. We're just going to have to allow them to change us. And September 11th definitely changed all of us. In a sense, the starting point for me is to observe that if there ever was a justification for government, it was 9/11. It's hard to imagine the private sector having been able to overcome the obstacles we collectively faced without its partnership with federal, state, and local government bodies and industry self-regulators. That being said, it's also impossible to imagine how the government could have achieved so much so quickly and impressively without the partnership that was forged with the private sector. In that sense, September 11 showed the incredible character of this unique country. We are bound together, each of us, by our shared values. And those shared values represent, in the most fundamental terms, our basic commitment to democracy. Every day, our commitment to democracy is tested. And no matter how well we've done in the past, the price of freedom and democracy is constantly rising to new tests and challenges and meeting them handily. Now, when the tragedy struck, everyone's first reaction was disbelief, shock, remorse, grief, and even fear. But those reactions were quickly overtaken by strength, courage, resolve, and even anger. It's somewhat trite, but nonetheless accurate to say that we came together as a nation, we pulled together as a nation. Police, firefighters, telephone technicians, electricians, financial institutions, members of the military, governments at every level, and civilians participated in rescue efforts. The same spirit of cooperation imbued the efforts by so many in the public and private sectors to restore the vitality of our securities markets, as you've just heard. First, last, and foremost, we were all painfully aware of the human aspects of the tragedy. Sadly, many people employed in the securities industry, as well as countless others, died, and we will forever grieve our losses. Fortunately, many people miraculously were evacuated to safety and reunited with loved ones. And as Wayne described, due in no small measure to his own great leadership, this included all of the commission's employees when our Northeast Regional Office was destroyed. When tragedy struck, we were immediately in contact with the leaders of our various securities markets, and in particular Dick Grasso, who admirably became the face of American capitalism. On a personal level, I started every day after 9/11 by talking with Dick first thing and with his counterpart, Wick Simmons, at NASDAQ. And I'm afraid Dick was the last person I spoke to at the end of every day, something my wife noted at least a little wistfully. Although we were all surprised by these attacks and the ultimate damage they inflicted, it seems obvious now that, of course, that's what they were intended to do. The perpetrators thought that they could take down our financial institutions and cripple American capitalisms. And theoretically, I suppose they could have succeeded, but the reality was that they really couldn't have ever succeeded. The tragedy produced a great outpouring of compassion and common sense. And rather than turn a crisis into some sort of competitive or political advantage, the securities industry, self-regulators, and local, state, and federal government bodies all came together, as you've heard. I think the common refrain was, how can we help? At the SEC, we made a decision very early in the day to let our so-called non-essential staff go early. I've always worried about that because basically everyone at the SEC is essential, but in any event, those are the official administrative terms that were used. Unfortunately for them, Annette Nazareth, David Becker, Mark Ratke, and I were virtually joined at the hip. Now, I didn't mind being joined at the hip with them. I'll leave it to history for them to decide how they felt about the same thing, but we were camped out at the SEC. Working together with so many capable and concerned individuals was inspirational. When the markets closed, or really more accurately, when they didn't open, as indeed they couldn't, the President's Working Group, as you heard, on capital markets sprang into action. And that group's principals were Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill, Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan, Presidential Economic Advisor Larry Lindsey, CFTC Chairman Jim Newsom, and me as SEC Chair. And of course, the real work was performed by, among others, Treasury Undersecretary Peter Fisher, Fed Vice Chairman Roger Ferguson, SEC General Counsel David Becker, and Roger Ferguson's wife, whose secret identity was as the SEC Market Regulation Director, Annette Nazareth. I think it's important to bear in mind and recall that there was absolutely no precedent for what had happened. And certainly, there was no precedent for how to deal with it. Indeed, I'm somewhat embarrassed to admit that, at least for me, it took two planes crashing into two buildings to persuade some of us that we weren't dealing with some vacationing yahoo who had lost his way. At the SEC, the tragedy required every single office and division to consider what issues they had and how we should resolve them. You might not think that there are 40 Act issues. You might not think there are accounting problems, but all of the various offices and divisions all did a superb job of thinking about what was affected, what could go wrong, and then how could we fix it. I think over the course of our efforts, we developed some core tenets, and some of them include, first and foremost, focusing on the safety and well-being of those citizens who are trying to rescue people trapped in the rubble created by the Twin Tower collapses. More than any other factor, we really learned that we couldn't have reopened the markets without endangering the potential of finding even one more person buried in all that rubble. A second tenet was just, as you've heard, being sensitive to the needs of our own employees. Every institution had this. Somehow government is very often thought of as being cool and indifferent to its employees, but we had to worry about all of our employees, not just in New York and the District of Columbia, where the impact was most direct, but all of the SEC's offices, because what we witnessed really had a very dramatic and very differing effects on very different people. As you've heard, another tenet was coordinating responses and reactions of the equity and options markets, ensuring, as you've heard, that when the markets reopened, they would stay reopened, providing critical government transparency. It became very clear to us quite early on that in times of a crisis, the public has a legitimate need to know exactly what's going on, what we were planning to do, and why we were moving in whatever direction we were moving. As I indicated, another tenet was figuring out what the potential problems that could be caused by this catastrophe, and creating a working team of all the various private and public sector organizations that had or could have had some role to play. Another important tenet for us, and I'm sure Annette will agree with this, as I know Dave Becker would if he were here, was making critical decisions on site. We thought it was imperative that we be physically present in the heart of New York's financial district to help assess the realities of the situation and to facilitate the necessary solutions. The other important tenet was viewing the problems that we faced as collective problems and encouraging those who were subject to our regulation to be equal partners in figuring out and implementing the methodology to get out of that mess. One amusing sidelight, to the extent there can be any in this effort, was we encouraged and solicited comments from all sorts of different areas of our society in the private sector, and we got some interesting but wild suggestions, and suffice it to say, we resisted the temptation to do everything anyone suggested to us. And particularly for those people who wanted us to ban all short trading, that was not going to happen. Barely hours after I went to sleep on 9/11, I made an appearance on ABC's Good Morning America to update the public on what was happening. And I remember vividly just how startled the hosts of the program were when, toward the end of the interview, I gratuitously volunteered that when the markets reopened, there would be some nifty values to be realized for those who were in the market purchasing various equity securities. I'm not sure Congress intended an SEC chairman to advocate stock purchases, but we were already focused on avoiding an imbalance of supply and demand, as Annette and Tom alluded to. And so as a result, necessity is always the mother of invention. Immediately after that, I think it was that David Becker, Annette, Mark Ratke, my chief of staff, Lisa Panicetti, my deputy chief of staff, Peter Fisher, and I got on a train to New York. That was the only way we could get to New York. It was difficult not only to get into New York, but it was really difficult to travel around certain portions of it. Governor Pataki had arranged for us to have several cars at our disposal with several uniformed and even potentially armed officers of the law ferrying us around. I think we found out just how bad this was, and you've heard some of this, so I won't dwell on it. When after our arrival and our first meetings on Wednesday, we visited the New York Stock Exchange and the surrounding financial district on Thursday morning. As you've heard, the scene was eerie and akin to something straight out of some science fiction movie depicting, say, an invasion from out of space. The usually teeming streets of the financial district were barren of cars. They were barren of people, save for a fairly large number of Marines in camouflage uniforms sporting machine guns and wearing surgical masks. A thin white powder, as I think you heard Tom indicate and others, covered the streets and sidewalks. And I remember thinking that this didn't look like the financial district of the most sophisticated financial center in the world, but rather like a third world country. Believe me when I say it was chilling. Seeing the pictures on TV of the buildings going down was terrible. Seeing that vista in on Thursday morning was absolutely chilling and unforgettable. And as you've heard, one of our first steps was to convene a meeting of the major markets, the major brokerage firms, Con Ed, Verizon, FEMA, the federal government's emergency management agency, the New York City's mayor's emergency agency, and Governor Pataki's emergency representatives. And our goal was to understand firsthand what was physically possible, but also what was not. And our secondary goal, once we achieved the first goal, was to figure out how to get the markets back up and running. And we proceeded to get updates periodically on the damage inflicted, the extent of the communications outages, the state of readiness of the major firms, and, of course, the precise status of rescue efforts. As I indicated, there were some who felt that the markets should have reopened immediately. Of course, the truth, which can be told now, was that they couldn't. More importantly, we really were terribly worried that if the markets reopened and then collapsed, we would never regain investor and public confidence again. And that meant that our goal was to get the markets to reopen as quickly as they could, but not a moment sooner than reasonable assurances could be provided that once they reopened, they were likely to stay open. I know that both Dick Grasso and Wick Simmons share that view. Of course, because so much pressure was anticipated, we thought it best as to that issue for the SEC to assume publicly the responsibility for the decision to defer opening. That led to some interesting emails that were circulated by some in the White House saying that they hoped the SEC would allow the markets to reopen soon. What was interesting about that decision, however, was that it was inconsistent with the actual way that all of us approached the crisis. As I indicated and as you've heard, we thought it was important for government to act as a facilitator for the goals everyone agreed on, not as the dictator or sole decision maker resolving all questions and all issues. We received marvelous support and assistance from all of the firms. On Thursday morning, we met at the New York Stock Exchange with the exchange's excellent regulatory and senior executive staff and with Verizon and Con Ed officials. That was the only meeting we held that occurred without major industry representatives because we wanted to get the straight skinny. Just how bad was the problem? What we learned was depressing. About 80% of the New York Stock Exchange's communication network was routed through a West Side Verizon routing station, and that station was taken out of operation. To make the system function, they were going to have to wait until all of those communication lines could be rerouted through a major East Side routing station. And worse, as I indicated, it was clear, particularly from FEMA and the mayor's emergency personnel, that if the financial district were reopened too soon, thousands of people would start streaming through and rescue efforts would be unalterably halted and damaged. Some of the firms thought they could resume trading immediately. Others knew they couldn't. It really made sense for us to proceed carefully, and although by Thursday morning I think we were fairly certain that Monday was going to be our target date for reopening, we thought it would be a mistake to decide that on either Wednesday or Thursday. We all thought we should decide matters one day at a time, and I think that proved to be the right course. On Thursday afternoon, we met, I think, at the offices of CS First Boston. And we again agreed that the markets shouldn't open on Friday. Another press conference was held, and throughout both days, I was actually in constant communication with Paul Sarbanes, Phil Graham, Mike Oxley, and John LaFalce, the chairs and the ranking minority members of both the Senate Banking Committee and the House Financial Services Committee. They all offered encouragement and assistance at every step of the way. I remember on a personal note, at one point in the meetings at CS First Boston, I got pulled out. I had my BlackBerry taken by Lisa Panicetti, who confiscated it. And she got a message from my wife, who had told her we live in an area of Washington which not coincidentally is called Calorama, and we live very near the Islamic mosque. And some point in the middle of Thursday, my family, my wife, and our two younger children were evicted from not just the house, but from the neighborhood. Everybody had to get out because there was a problem. And I think Lisa thought that this was, she came in with tears in her eyes, but as it turned out, by the time I talked to my wife, who's very calm, cool, and collected, everything seemed to have passed over. In fact, she was so collected that my son, Robert, who at the time was 11, said to her, having watched all this, he said, "You know, Mom, Dad's working in the government. Does that mean that the terrorists are going to try and kill him?" And with her usual humor and wit and my family's usual approach of constantly teaching me to be humble, she said to him, "No, Robert, nobody really cares about the SEC." For the SEC, the terrorist attacks imposed a triple whammy. The markets were taken down. Many friends and colleagues of ours were murdered, and our New York office, as you've heard, crumbled into rubble, taking with it not just offices and computers and files, but on a different note, personal treasures and possessions. Shortly before I came back to the commission, Fried Frank, my former law firm, had managed to entice Carmen Lawrence, who had been Wayne's predecessor from the New York Regional Office, to join, and she had left all of her memorabilia in her office, which of course all got destroyed. She just kept delaying picking it up and so on. Now, I think, as you've heard, a primary concern was a need to account for every member of the New York office staff. And as Wayne indicated, the last person, this young woman who was a compliance inspector, actually returned my call shortly before midnight. And she told me about what you've heard as to how she escaped, and then told me that she walked all the way home to the Upper West Side, I believe. She showered and then said, starting at around 4 o'clock, she spent the remainder of the day in church, thanking God for sparing her life and the lives of every single one of her colleagues. You can imagine it was a very emotional conversation. Just as in the private sector, we needed to move quickly to attend to the details of making our New York office vibrant and functioning again, and to begin the healing and emotional recovery process. As Wayne indicated, the community reached out to us. I think under Wayne Carlin's effective leadership, all of the staff members were able to communicate with one another. I think one of the most remarkable things that Wayne and Jane Seidman's leadership produced was that we were the first federal agency back into the financial district in little over a month, and that could not have really been done without their leadership. I think it's hard to focus on just how devastating this kind of tragedy is to the people who survive. People in the financial district, as you heard, saw friends, relatives, and colleagues throwing themselves out of the windows of buildings that had been struck. And one of the things that we did, and again, here, particularly in the New York office, Wayne was very instrumental in this, all of our employees were encouraged to use our employee assistance program. And those who couldn't work were given very liberal leave. We just decided we had a no-questions-asked policy. In a few cases, some asked to be reassigned. I remember vividly one letter I received from one of our more recent hires' fathers. We had hired some young man as a lawyer. The father wrote me a personal handwritten note saying that his son was so excited to be at the SEC. This was something he had really wanted, but he knew he could not go back to work at the New York regional office. And I'm really proud to say that working again through Wayne and working through Jane Seidman and others, I think we fulfilled every request. And again, no questions asked. People wanted to move, they were allowed to move at will. As you've heard from Annette in particular and Tom, next we focused on restoring our markets, and of course that was critical. I think it was critical to our collective psyche, and it was critical to the message we sent around the world about our freedom and way of life. People really did work day and night to ensure that trading resumed without a hitch and that all trading opportunities once again were available. On Friday, we focused on how we would reopen our markets. And as you've heard it, we decided to defer reopening until Monday so that we could use the weekend to test out the new communications and electrical networks that we were now told had been installed. And that was where the non-event of Y2K came in very, very handy. Because of the work that the agency did, mostly in Annette's division, in preparing for that potential but ultimately non-existent crisis, we really were able to send teams of people, volunteers as you've heard, to major locations around New York City, and the equipment could be tested because these were all folks who knew what to look for. You know, it's great to talk about all these things. I know I would not have had the slightest idea what to look for, but as I was coming back on Friday by train, we saw a bunch of the young staffers going up in jeans and sweatshirts and so on, and it was it really was incredible. And the relatively few glitches that were found were readily repaired. Over the weekend, we negotiated what was then a tentative agreement. I'm here, glad to hear from Ed Qualwasser that it ultimately became permanent, between Dick Grasso and Wick Simmons to deal with the eventuality that one or the other of the markets might stumble. And we wanted an agreement in place that assured everyone that if one or the other of them went down, all of the securities could still be traded. I think to everyone's credit, we were able to achieve real resolutions of all of these issues in what was an incredible and short period of time. And by the Monday, the 17th, as you've heard, all of the nation's securities markets resumed trading. At the time, some played up the fact that it was the longest hiatus in trading, but if you think about it, it was an incredibly short period of time given the kind of damage and destruction. And when the markets reopened, they didn't give way to panic selling. The delays in resuming trading gave investors time to reflect and to speak up in their own way about the strength of America's markets, and everyone heard them. Everyone heard it wasn't possible to destroy what we have built so many years. In the wake of September 11th, this extraordinary level of cooperation really took on almost unimaginable dimensions. The New York Stock Exchange opened a portion of its floor to accommodate trading in equities and exchange-traded funds by the Amex. In less than a week, the entire options business of the Amex was moved to the Philadelphia Stock Exchange. And brokerage firms that prior to September 11th were looking, as they should have been, for every conceivable advantage over their competitors, afterwards were providing space to competitors who had suffered as a result of the attacks. And in a sense, the most competitive markets in the world demonstrated that they were also the most compassionate. I think that this was a spirit of cooperation and compassion that we all sought to continue throughout my tenure at the Commission and beyond. I think we can be justifiably proud of the public and private sector cooperation that followed September 11th. We did learn a number of lessons. I think lessons that continue to have relevance to every issue that the SEC continues to grapple with. Some of them, but by no means all of them, were the importance of people. In a word, there really are no insignificant individuals. The importance of risk assessment, the need for planned redundancy without geographical overlap. I think the value of listening as well as speaking. The need for city, state, and federal agencies to work together. The advantages of partnership between public and private sectors. The importance that government must apply its creative ideas not just to those it regulates, but also to itself. And the need to reassess what had happened, not for the purpose of affixing blame or approbation. When we went into the review with the Fed and the controller of the currency, it was explicitly with the view that it was to be prospective only. It was not to find fault, but to recommend ways in which we could all improve if, God forbid, we ever were to have the same thing. I think having the Fed, OCC, and SEC ultimately collaborate on the lessons learned monograph, which I believe was a phenomenal job done by, in particular, at the Commission, Annette and Bob Colby, just showed how effective I think people can be. And of course, the most important lesson, at least that I learned, which is no matter how bad things may seem, they really can always get worse. The city of New York, my hometown, really showed its greatness. New York City was long ago dubbed the most hopeful city on earth, and it still is. E.B. White compared it to a local willow tree. His prophetic words have renewed resonance today. It's a battered tree, long suffering and much climbed, held together by strands of wire, but beloved by those who know it. In a way, it symbolizes the city. Life under difficulties, growth against odds, sap rise in the middle of concrete, and the steady reach for the sun. I hope we continue to grow and that we always reach for the sun. If we do, we will honor the spirit of those we lost on September 11th, and we'll also be able to meet whatever challenges confront us. Thank you.
We have a couple minutes for a question or two. We'll have to, because of the webcast, we need to repeat the question for the rest of our audience who are not here in the room. But if there are any questions for Chairman Pitt, let's hear them now.
Great.
Okay. Thank you, Harvey. And thank you to all of our panelists earlier. This was great to hear from those who were directly involved with the repair and restoration of our markets during that difficult time. Also, I want to mention that we've had visitors to our virtual museum who have shared remembrances of the events of September 11 and their impact on the markets. We're going to gather these at the end of the month and post them in our museum as we do with everything we do. And if you'd like to share anything, please visit us at sechistorical.org. That's it for this annual meeting. Thank you for being part of it, and thank you for your continued support of the Society. Good evening.